an elite private prep school in New England, is plagued by scandal.
The first thing you said was take off all your clothes and get in the whirlpool.
I didn't know I could say no. Who am I going to say no to?
He got on top of me. This was not part of his job.
People didn't realize that that might just be the tip of the iceberg of his behavior.
The school didn't report to anybody. It's unforgivable.
And the cover-up endures for decades.
These people move on to other schools and continue to abuse new victims.
I thought, I gotta tell somebody, because this guy has been doing this to lots of other people.
In depth, insightful, in a class of its own, it's America's leading journal, Vanity Fair. Contributing editor Benjamin Wallace uncovers St. George's Hidden Dragons. St. George's. The elite New England prep school sits on a hill in this picturesque seaside town. But beneath its proper facade, things at St. George's are not as idyllic as they seem.
St. George's was started in the late 19th century to educate the sons of the Gilded Age elite. It was an Episcopalian school. There is a religious component to the education there. Over the years, the graduates would include, you know, Bushes and Biddles and Astors and Vanderbilts.
From my class alone, we have an Oscar winner. We have a New York Times bestselling novelist. It's a student body that draws from wealthy white Protestant families from mainland Philadelphia, New England, Chicago.
Students would be arriving in chauffeur-driven limousines. School vacations, the limousines would pick them up and they'd be going off to Gstaad or someplace like that to go skiing.
It was a place where self-sufficiency was highly regarded. Boarding schools are places where you go to learn how to be an adult and you go to learn how to be independent.
Catherine Finney, a member of the class of 1979, arrives at St. George's in her junior year after her family moves from Connecticut to Rhode Island.
The experience of going to a school like that always stays with you and stays with your identity to some degree. The campus is absolutely gorgeous. You're just looking right out at the ocean. I mean, it's really idyllic. I mean, if you're gonna suffer through high school, suffer through it in a place that's as pretty as that.
But in April 2015, Catherine and other alumni of the school receive a disturbing letter from the administration.
The headmaster, Eric Peterson, sent out a letter to alumni saying that they were aware of past sexual abuse by at least one St. George's staff member. In this letter, he also said that they had hired an independent investigator to undertake a full inquiry into the scope of abuse that might have happened at St. George's.
When she reads the letter, Catherine is jolted by a distant memory from her senior year at St. George's.
Hadn't given it any thought in a long, long time, but came back with a vengeance.
Catherine was a typical young girl, one who got involved in athletics.
Field hockey, ice hockey, and lacrosse were the primary things I played.
During her senior year, Catherine sprains her ankle during a field hockey game.
I was told to go see Al Gibbs. He was the athletic trainer at St. George's School. He had a constant presence on campus. He would be standing on the sidelines as we were playing games. He was Gibbsy.
Al Gibbs came to the school full-time in 1973. He was in his 60s. He had a gruff demeanor. He was a Navy vet.
Even though the school turned co-ed 6 years earlier, there are few facilities for female athletes.
When girls started attending St. George's, there was no girls' locker room. They had to change for sports in their dorm rooms. And if they had an injury and they went to see Al Gibbs, they had to go through the boys' locker room to get to his athletic training room.
His training room was a fairly small room at the end of the locker room. There was one of these, you know, whirlpool training tubs in the middle of the room. The first thing he said was, take off all your clothes and get in the whirlpool. That made me think, why would I need to do that? It was, you know, my ankle. But Al Gibbs was the trainer, and Al Gibbs presented himself as sort of this, you know, medical authority kind of guy. And he was on the level of a teacher. I negotiated a pair of shorts out of him so that I wouldn't be totally naked in the whirlpool. I got in the whirlpool, and he said, I'm gonna put this heat lamp kind of above you so that you stay warm in the whirlpool. I'm gonna cover your eyes so that this heat lamp doesn't burn your eyes. I think there was part of me that was already on high alert. My eyes are covered, and what am I doing, and what is he doing? And yeah, it was definitely not a comfortable environment.
Catherine remains in the whirlpool for about 15 minutes when Gibbs instructs her to get out. But she has no way to cover her partially naked body.
He had this conversation that he was going to show me how to properly dry my breasts for long-term preservation of breast tissue. So he gave me the hands-on proper breast drying technique. And while he was doing that, he was appraising my body. By that time, I think I was probably already so far gone emotionally because it was just so, I don't know what, appalling. You know, mortifying probably would be the right word. I don't remember leaving that office. I just know that at some point, I thought, I'm never setting foot in that office again. I never confronted Al Gibbs about it. I didn't tell anyone.
And Catherine is not the only prep school student to harbor such harrowing memories.
St. George's is not the only school that this has happened in. We have heard from dozens of other schools.
In May 2016, it was revealed that at least 67 private schools in New England have faced accusations that staffers sexually abused or harassed more than 200 students.
Private schools, I think, have the added barrier of being very reputation focused. I think people are probably more reluctant even to come forward when what they have to say is so at odds with the images of these places.
When Catherine receives the letter from the school revealing the recent allegations of abuse, she reaches out to some old friends.
Catherine Finney went to have lunch with a bunch of friends from St. George's. They all started telling about their own experiences with Gibbs, and she realized for the first time that she wasn't the only one this had happened to.
I was really shocked, you know, 35 years later, to find out that other people who were and are some of my closest friends went through the same kind of experience, and we didn't say anything to each other.
These were girls who experienced everything from massages to being asked to undress to having their breasts fondled. And Gibbs took photographs in some instances. He would put a towel over their eyes so they couldn't see what he was doing, but sometimes they would hear clicks or see kind of the flash of a light.
At first, Catherine doesn't believe her one-time experience with Gibbs is a story worth reporting to the school's investigator.
I really didn't want to be involved. I don't really know what my story is going to add. And then as the numbers grew and the stories came out, I had an inner reaction that was much stronger than I would have expected. Trauma's trauma, and once is enough.
Catherine and her friends join an ever-growing group of survivors recalling their experiences of sexual abuse. Was Gibbs the only one? Or were there other possible predators on the staff of the exclusive St. George's School? Alumni of the prestigious St. George's School are stunned to learn their alma mater is investigating allegations of sexual abuse at the school. Some fear the elite prep school may have a history of systemic abuse. In early September, St. George's students are preparing to return to campus for the new school year. The mother of a sophomore student asks for a meeting with the headmaster.
Tony Zane was the new headmaster who started in 1972. He was kind of out of central casting, you know, wore tweed and had a Dalmatian with him at all times.
The mother informs Zane that her son confessed something deeply disturbing. The boy claims the school's associate chaplain, Reverend Howard White, raped him.
Howard White, he was known as Howdy. He came there in 1971.
Prior to St. George's School, he had worked at St. Paul's School in New Hampshire. Howard White had a relationship with this student at St. George's School, and it was an advisor-mentor sort of relationship.
He was not one of the well-to-do kids. He felt out of place at St. George's.
Howdy White took him on a number of trips, just the two of them, outside of the campus, and we don't know exactly why he was taking him on these trips.
Howard White took him to West Virginia, took him to a hotel in Boston. He took him to a campground in Canada.
In each of those locations, the student says White sexually assaulted him.
This boy said there were acts which constituted rape. There were multiple occasions over 2 years.
The student says he was 14 years old when the abuse began. For 2 years, he told no one about White's actions.
It's very uncommon for a victim to come forward and report that something's happened to them. They think nobody's going to believe them, or they think that it's their fault. Sometimes they don't tell because they're just ashamed, they're embarrassed.
The student had some complicated feelings in the 70s. These were issues that no one really knew how to talk about. The student said that he did confront White, and White said, if it stops, I'll make your life miserable. I've given a lot to you, now I want something back.
By the end of his sophomore year, the student says he couldn't take it anymore. Now 16 years old, the boy finally summons the courage to tell his parents what Reverend White has done.
At that point, the parents called the school, and then the mother met with Tony Zane soon after.
Zane is shocked by what he learns about the school chaplain's relationship with the boy.
I think the culture between students and faculty members was that you really weren't going to speak up about much. Also, you know, it's a very WASPy culture. We're not overly emotive or expressive to begin with, particularly things of, you know, a shameful nature or a sexual nature.
Tony Zane confronted Howdy White, and he said Howdy White denied everything. At that point, Zane said he was going to get the lawyers involved, and then White admitted it.
On September 12th, 1974, Zane engineers Reverend White's resignation.
Zane told the board that White was leaving the school for unbecoming conduct involving a male student the previous spring, but he told the student body that White was leaving for personal reasons.
Tony Zane never reported this to any state authorities.
Since the 1960s, we've had what we call mandatory reporting laws in this country. They say that if you think a child is being harmed physically, emotionally, sexually, you must report to the proper authorities so that that can be investigated.
Not telling the student body, not trying to find out if there were other people there that he abused, and it's unforgivable.
It seems to some observers that reputation is more important to prestigious schools than justice. A 2016 Boston Globe investigation into sexual abuse at New England boarding schools found 11 cases in which employees who were accused of sexual misconduct went on to work at other schools.
There's a term called passing the trash. It refers to schools or other institutions, such as the Catholic Church, getting rid of an abuser or molester without telling anyone else. So these people move on to other schools, to other churches, and continue to abuse new victims. After leaving St. George's, White became the dean at a girls' prep school in Virginia. Then he had an administrator job at a day school in North Carolina.
Then, a decade after leaving St. George's School, White takes a position as rector at a church in North Carolina. There, he meets 15-year-old Forrest Parker.
When I got with Dr. White, I felt safe. I finally got someone that wants to take care of me.
Forrest grew up in abject poverty. He grew up in an area outside of Waynesville called Pig Holler, I understand. That's what people locally called it.
Forrest's mother fought cancer, and his stepfather was an abusive alcoholic. Starting at age 3, Forrest and his 2 brothers are frequently in the custody of social services.
We were always with, like, foster families and stuff. Sometimes we would go back and stay with Mama, but not for long, because Mama was always sick and always in a nursing home or the hospital.
When Forrest was 15, and he was living at a place called Crossnor School, it was a residential facility, but in the summer it would shut down. There was nowhere for him to go. It was agreed that he was to spend the summer with Howard White. Mr. White was approved as a foster parent, and he was trusted by many.
Forrest and White live alone in the rectory. Reverend White dotes on the teen, and Forrest enjoys the attention.
He bought me suits. He bought me a nice bicycle. I had never had none of that. He had went and bought a brand new car. I had never been in a new car before, and I smelled a new car, and I thought, this is pretty cool.
2 weeks after the start of summer break, White takes Forrest on a trip to Washington, D.C.
Reverend White said that he had some business trips planned for the D.C. and Maryland area, and he actually told the Department of Social Services that he was planning to take Forrest with him.
Going to the Smithsonian, and I remember seeing the airplane hanging from the ceiling, and we had a nice motel. Had a motel with a swimming pool in it. Never been to a motel with a swimming pool in it.
Later that night, Forrest says he settled into his motel bed.
Dr. White, I remember he got into bed with me, and I turned away from him because I'm going to try to go to sleep. And then you could feel him get up against you, like on your back. And then he had intercourse with me, and I didn't say nothing. I think I just tried to lay there and act like I was asleep, but I wasn't asleep. And then the next morning, he just got up and acted like nothing was different. And I knew it wasn't right, and it hurt. But what am I gonna do? I'm in Washington, and I get to see all these nice things.
Forrest says he never told anyone what happened that night.
Hell, nobody don't like me, no how. Nobody don't want me. And plus, he's showing me things, and I've got a brand new bicycle. I've got these nice clothes. And all I know to do is just not say nothing.
A few days later, White and Forrest return to the rectory. Then, on the 4th of July, the 15-year-old attends a party with some friends.
Everyone was going to get together to watch the fireworks, and everybody was already drinking beer.
He managed to drink enough that he described it as getting a buzz.
When Forrest returned home that night, he says Reverend White was waiting up for him. He sees that Forrest has been drinking.
He told me, he said, well, why don't you just sleep in my bed tonight? And I didn't know I could say no. because I figured if I said no, he was going to kick me out.
Fifteen-year-old Forrest Parker lives in a church rectory with his temporary guardian, Reverend Howard White. He has no idea that a decade earlier, White was dismissed as the chaplain at the prestigious St. George's School for what the administration called unbecoming conduct involving a student. Forrest Parker says that White sexually assaulted him on a trip to Washington, D.C., just 2 weeks after he moved into the rectory.
If there is a God, and I don't know if there is or isn't, but if there is, Dr. White's in trouble. Because he ain't going to heaven. You can't do what he did and go to heaven. But I didn't tell nobody. I didn't want to give up what I had there because I didn't have nowhere else to go.
3 weeks later, Forrest returns home from a 4th of July party after drinking a few beers.
White could tell that he'd been drinking. He said, why don't you go sleep it off in my room?
I went up there and I was thinking, maybe he won't mess with you. I tried the same thing that I did the other times. I'd turn him away from me so he would be facing my back. But then he had intercourse with me. And then I thought to myself, I thought, this ain't gonna stop. You gotta do something. Damn, you'll turn 16 in 2 days. 2 days, you can get the hell out of here. And that's what I did.
When he was 16, he could no longer be forced to live where he didn't want to live. So when his birthday came around, he left.
Forrest tells no one about White's alleged abuse until 2016, when he reads an article in a North Carolina paper about allegations against White at St. George's School, where White had worked.
Hell, I didn't even want to talk about it. I didn't even want to think about it. But when I saw what I saw in the paper, I thought, damn, I got to tell somebody, because this guy has been doing this not just to me, but to lots of other people.
In March 2016, Forrest reports Dr. White's alleged abuse to North Carolina authorities.
We're very fortunate in North Carolina that there is no criminal statute of limitations for felony sexual abuse. The matter is still under investigation, and I am very, very hopeful that charges will be filed.
In October 2016, the Episcopal Church removes 75-year-old Howard White from the priesthood. He had served as a religious leader for 50 years.
They did a full investigation and they determined that this man does not belong in the priesthood. That's a pretty strong statement, pretty strong action to take.
Everything that happened to me could have been avoided had these other people, whoever it may be, did what they were supposed to have done. It could all been avoided.
Reverend Howard White moved from job to job with ease, leaving victims in his wake. When he was terminated by St. George's School in 1974, the accusations were never passed on to potential employers. White is just one of six former St. George's employees who have been named as alleged sexual abusers.
We're likely to find more predators among teachers who spend time with kids outside of a classroom. So somebody who's a coach, somebody who's in drama, somebody who's in music. These are people who have access to kids and their boundaries start to blur.
Franklin Coleman was a charismatic figure at St. George's. He arrived in 1980. He was a choir master. He taught music theory and history.
When I arrived at the school in the fall of 1983, Franklin Coleman was assigned as my advisor.
Bryce Traister soon learns that Coleman has cultivated a unique social clique at the school.
My first kind of introduction to the social milieu that Franklin Coleman organized around himself was when I received a handwritten invitation to attend one of his parties. I showed it to one of the student leaders on my dorm floor, and he said to me, "Oh, you've been chosen."
He kind of created an exclusive club called the Colemanites. Then they would, you know, go to his apartment. The boys all wore black tie, and they listened to classical music and jazz.
I felt like he was actually listening to my opinions. The idea that you were kind of worthy of notice, I think, is something that many of us responded to.
But then there were an even smaller group of students who Franklin Coleman seemed to have a sexual interest in.
He would try to approach them in different ways, and the extent to which they didn't resist would determine whether or not he would try something additional. He was a skillful perpetrator.
Franklin Coleman, he was giving some kids vodka. Sometimes he'd answer the door in his underwear. He would give students massages or have them give him massages. He groped some students. He showed gay porn to at least one student.
He never laid a finger on me, but it did not seem like an impossibility to me that it might have happened with somebody else. The very culture that he constructed, that he choreographed, should have been setting alarm bells off, and it would set off an alarm bell today.
Franklin Coleman's invitation-only social club continues for 8 years, until 1988, when one student comes forward. The student tells the school counselor that Coleman had slept in the same bed with him on trips, shown him pornography, and once gave him a massage while the student was naked.
The school counselor went to George Andrews, who was Zane's successor as headmaster. Andrews confronted Franklin Coleman, and he said Coleman denied nothing. Andrews fired Coleman, but it was presented as a resignation. Coleman was given $10,000 in return, for which he agreed not to sue the school. And the school was told by Andrews that Coleman had left because of emotional stress and pressure.
Franklin Coleman has never publicly spoken about or denied the allegations.
Again, the school didn't report to anybody. They didn't go to social services to talk about him. Part of a pattern at St. George's, you know.
After leaving St. George's, Coleman worked with school choirs in Philadelphia. Then he worked at a friend's school in Delaware, and eventually he wound up at a prep school in Tampa. Coleman now lives in New Jersey.
Sexual abuse at cloistered institutions like St. George's is rarely exposed. It leaves a legacy of victims haunted by their childhood experiences. Two months before her 16th birthday, Winnie Farrar's family drops her off at the school her parents had always dreamed of sending her.
I'm from New Canaan, Connecticut. I was in public school, and from there, I went to St. George's. I was in the only second class of girls to be there. There were 300 boys, and in my class, there were 40 girls.
The teachers who'd been there a long time made it clear to them that they didn't like the fact that there were women there, said to them, "This is a boys' school that happened to have some girls in it."
I came in as a 10th grader. You know, I think coming in as a sophomore, it was difficult because you didn't come in with the first class. I had a really hard time fitting in, but I was a pretty good athlete. I played basketball in the winter, but field hockey and lacrosse were my main sports that I played. I really enjoyed sports. It was a comfort zone for me, and I felt really accepted in that environment. In the fall, playing field hockey, I had a fair amount of discomfort in my legs. My shin splints actually were really problematic.
She's on a winning team, and the coach is determined to keep one of the star players on the field. The coach sends Winnie to the school's athletic trainer, Al Gibbs.
It seemed like a reasonable place to be going. He was the go-to person that would keep you playing your sports, and, you know, he was friendly.
Friendly Al Gibbs would affect Winnie's life in ways she could never imagine. The year is 1974, and 15-year-old Winnie Farrar is a star athlete at the elite St. George's School. Her field hockey coach sends her to see the school's athletic trainer, Al Gibbs, to treat her chronic shin splints.
People thought he was kind of a charming or slightly odd old man who was a little touchy-feely, but people didn't realize that, you know, that might just be the tip of the iceberg of his behavior.
Gibbs massages Winnie's lower legs and teaches her stretches to help relieve the pain in her shins.
It didn't seem anything that was out of the ordinary for me. It wasn't really until, I would say, the end of the winter basketball season that things started to get really uncomfortable for me in working with him.
One afternoon, Gibbs takes Winnie's physical therapy in an unexpected direction.
He said, you know, why don't you get in this whirlpool? Just take your clothes off. He was the athletic trainer. I was a student. And if I wanted to play sports, I needed to follow what this person in power was telling me to do. So if he needed me to remove my clothes for the whirlpool, that's what I did.
I think that Gibbs, like many people who are sexual perpetrators, their behaviors escalate as they come to understand that they can do things and there are no consequences for doing those things.
I would spend time in that whirlpool, get out, it would seem appropriate. But then he tried to kiss me on the mouth. He forced himself on me. It was completely inappropriate and scary. And I really thought, something is wrong with this picture.
Winnie rebuffs the trainer's advances, but she says Gibbs warned her not to tell anyone what happened in his office.
He implied that if I said really anything, that he was going to have me off the sports teams. And for me, that was devastating. I already was having a difficult time socially at school, and sports was my safety place. That was my place where I felt most comfortable. So I was gonna do what it was gonna take to play sports. I just thought, I'm just going to stay quiet about it and ignore it.
Gibbs was a decorated Navy veteran. He wore a medical patch on his jacket. So these girls looked at him as an authority figure. There weren't a lot of female teachers to whom the girls could turn.
This was a male-dominated society. Gibbs was part of this male culture in which anything the guys did was pretty much okay. Anything the girls did, they would be told that they were acting inappropriately.
Winnie, an all-star athlete, continues to play field hockey and lacrosse in her sophomore and junior years. Gibbs continues to molest Winnie.
I didn't tell my coach. I didn't have a context to be able to see that I really should tell an adult that something was going on.
In the fall of her senior year, Winnie is seriously injured during field hockey practice.
I was 17. I had stepped on a field hockey ball while running, and I had snapped my ankle.
Winnie's coach, once again, sends her to see Gibbs.
He said, get on the table. And then he got on top of me. And he pinned me down by my right wrist. I realized this was not part of his job. And he was, in fact, trying to sexually assault me. He was very strong, and he was really holding me by my wrist. I just wanted to get out of there, so I had a lot of adrenaline. I had my left hand free, So I was able to push him off of me, and I just left. At that point, I was so traumatized that I felt like I just needed to forget about it, and I never went back.
After the attempted assault, Winnie continues playing sports, but even when injured, she refuses to see Al Gibbs.
I actually just played with injuries. I didn't really care what my coaches told me.
Winnie graduates from St. George's School in 1977. She never tells anyone about Al Gibbs.
I never thought of going to the headmaster about this. I felt like this was my own issue that I had to deal with by myself. But I never said anything to anyone else. I was too scared. You're away from home. In a lot of ways, they're expecting you to be an adult. I wasn't an adult, I was a kid.
Protected by the silence, Al Gibbs continues to assault girls at St. George's School until finally, victims start to speak up. Former students of the prestigious St. George's School finally reveal the dark secrets they had kept for decades. Catherine Finney, class of 1979, and Winnie Farrar, who graduated 2 years earlier, both say that Al Gibbs, the school's athletic trainer, repeatedly sexually abused them in his training room. His secret serial abuse of young athletes started in 1973 and lasted 7 years.
In 1980, Gibbs abused a girl. She said to me, she went to the headmaster to report this. The headmaster then interviewed a number of other girls and learned there was this pattern with Gibbs, and he fired him.
Headmaster Tony Zane announces Gibbs' departure at a school assembly, where he tells everyone Gibbs is leaving for medical reasons.
Amazingly, despite the circumstances of his departure from St. George's, Gibbs received an annual stipend from, I think, the year of his departure up until 1989 of about $1,200. Zane also wrote a recommendation for him.
He certainly didn't report Gibbs to the police. He didn't report him to any social service agencies. And more importantly, he didn't give the girls the opportunity to understand that what happened to them was abuse and to try to deal with it then. Instead, what we've got is a bunch of women in their 50s who are just starting to deal with it now.
After she graduates from high school, Winnie represses the memories of the assaults. But 30 years later, when she receives a letter from the school in April 2015, her memories come flooding back. The school is opening a sexual misconduct investigation centered around former employees.
I had fury. I was so mad at Gibbs. I was so mad at the situation. It's hard to talk about this because there's probably other things that happened that I don't remember. And maybe it's okay not to remember.
In September 2016, a comprehensive investigation is made public. What it reveals sends shockwaves throughout the school and alumni community.
It was hundreds of pages long. It documented that there were 61 victims between 1970 and 1989, and that there were at least six faculty or staff who had committed abuse against students.
One employee in particular stands out. More than half of the victims say they were sexually assaulted by Al Gibbs.
I was amazed at the numbers. I mean, people had to come forward, and there may be lots of people who didn't.
You never know the full extent. There are people who go to their graves without telling the full story.
Al Gibbs continued to maintain his innocence during his time at St. George's and never spoke publicly about the allegations. He died in 1996. Today, many abuse survivors and other alumni have mixed feelings about their time at St. George's School.
These are schools where parents were sending their kids to be taken care of, to form their characters and their identities, and you know, that's where the worst thing that's ever happened to them happened.
It's not a one-sided picture for me. I got a wonderful education at St. George's, and it's served me well ever since. And I made friends there that I have to this day.
Of course I thought it was the elite protecting its own. And I think the school had a reputation to uphold.
I mean, I understand why maybe good people, otherwise decent people, didn't make the right call. But there was still a commitment on the school's part to enable justice to happen for these students rather than spend years and years and years preventing that from happening for the good of the school.
How can we make this stop? The first most important thing is to understand that the primary obligation is to the students.
The most important people in the story are the survivors. It's not the school.
I'm one of the lucky ones. How many people have been through something similar to what I've been through that haven't made it to the point to where they're able to tell their story? So I feel as if it's my responsibility to let other people know that it's not right.